This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As of today, it's illegal for Israelis to live in Gaza. Israeli soldiers and police knocked on doors this morning in 21 Gaza settlements and four others on the West Bank to hand out notices that give settlers 48 hours to leave the territory or face eviction by force. At some houses, in some settlements, they faced resistance. A great many settlers vowed defiance, and they're joined by thousands of allies who've slipped into the settlements to protest the pullback. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon shocked many of his countrymen when he proposed the withdrawal 20 months ago, the first ever Israeli withdrawal from land claimed by the Palestinians for their future state. Tonight, he told Israel Radio, "This act is essential for Israel. Believe me," he added, "the pain that I feel with this act is the full realization that we must do it. We cannot hold on to Gaza forever." On this first day of the disengagement, we'll hear from a reporter on the ground in Gaza's largest settlement and from a settler who's already pulled up roots. We also want to hear your questions about this moment. Why is Gaza so important? Will withdrawal offer Israel more security? What about the West Bank? What happens when Palestinians take over in Gaza? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Later in the program, we'll go to Baghdad for an update on Iraq's draft constitution. Some reports say agreement's been reached on all but 2 points. But first, the disengagement from Gaza. And joining us now from the settlement known as Neve Dekalim, is Matty Friedman, a reporter for the Jerusalem Post, and for the magazine, the Jerusalem Report. I'm going to get through this somehow. Nice of you to join us today.
Hi, Neil. How you doing?
All right. I wonder, what did you see today? Was there physical resistance to the Israeli military and police?
There was no physical violence. What happened this morning was that a few hundred police officers showed up at the gate of Neve Dekalim, which is the largest of Gaza's 21 Jewish settlements. There's about 500 families here. They showed up to serve evacuation orders to the families in Neve Dekalim. The orders say, as everyone here already knows, it is now illegal for you to be in Gaza, and the army is going to evacuate you by force over the next couple weeks if you don't leave voluntarily. The gate to the settlement was blocked by several hundred, maybe even 1,000 of the locals and of the hundreds of supporters who've come from all over Israel to back them up, and they prevented the police from entering the settlement. This lasted for a couple hours in an extremely hot day. There was verbal abuse on the part of the residents, but absolutely no physical violence whatsoever. A few hours after they showed up at the front gate of the settlement, the police kind of snuck in the back gate of Neve Dekalim in an attempt to get those evacuation orders to the settlers. The settlers immediately found out that they had come in the back door. The 1,000 people who had been at the front gate rushed to the back gate and basically stopped them from getting in the settlement from the other side. The police, after a few hours of trying, by about 2 o'clock had folded up the evacuation orders and disappeared.
Now, I know you spent the day talking with some families as well. What are they doing today?
Well, the truth is that people on Neve Dekalim are packing. I'm sitting in the room of a family who's lived here for 20 years in this house, and the room is full of boxes. There's a cupboard here that's been taken apart. And a similar scene is repeated in a lot of the houses here at Neve Dekalim. There are still people here at Neve Dekalim, and even more so at the hard-line ideological settlements in Gaza, settlements like Kfar Darum and Netzarim, where people are still in denial about the withdrawal. Even as it is underway, they still believe that it's not going to happen, and they still refuse to take any steps that acknowledge that it's going to happen. But here in Neve Dekalim, which is a religious settlement populated by ideological people, people are not in denial. People here are pragmatic, and they understand that this is going to happen, and people here are packing up.
I did want to ask you, though, about that aspect of denial. There are those, as you just mentioned, who said this day would never come. Well, here it is. What are they doing?
The day has not yet come, as far as these people are concerned. The day will come when soldiers arrive to forcibly evict people from their houses, and that day hasn't arrived. As of today, it's illegal to live in Gaza, and beginning on Wednesday morning, the army is going to be coming to the settlement, in an order that no one knows yet. No one knows what are the first settlements that will be evacuated. The army will come in and start to forcibly evict people who refuse to evacuate themselves voluntarily. When the soldiers show up at those settlements and knock on doors and say, leave your house or we're going to take you out by force, that is when these people are going to have to deal with the denial they've been living in for the past 18 months over which we've seen this plan develop. But the situation is different here. Most of the people here are not going to leave voluntarily. Most of the people here are packing up, and they're waiting for the soldiers to knock on their door. My impression has been garnered over dozens of conversations with the people here that they won't be able to live with themselves afterwards if they don't wait until the last moment. And as far as they're concerned, the last moment is when the soldier knocks on the door. People here are not planning violent resistance. People suggested to me that the soldiers would knock on the door and they would invite them in and offer them a cup of coffee, explain to them why they think this plan is such a terrible idea, maybe show them the house that they lived in before leaving without offering any resistance whatsoever.
Maddie Friedman, thanks very much for taking time out. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Maddie Friedman is a reporter for the Jerusalem Report, and he joined us by phone from the largest Jewish settlement in Gaza, Neve Dekalim. And we're going to be taking your questions today about the Gaza withdrawal, about what it means, about why it's important. If you want to know why Israel is disengaging, about the legality of the process, the history of the region, or what might happen next, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us are Shibli Telhami, the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He's with us from the studios at Brookings, right down Massachusetts Avenue here in Washington, D.C. Always nice to have you on the program, Shibli.
Good to be with you.
Also with us is Dennis Ross, the author of The Missing Piece, the inside story of the fight for the Middle East, a counselor at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And Ambassador Ross has been kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. Thank you for being with us.
Nice to be with you. And Shibli.
Let me ask you, first of all, is the disengagement, is this part of the peace process?
In a sense, it was a decision taken by Ariel Sharon, not as part of the, quote, roadmap per se, but as a decision that Israel would take on its own, a unilateral decision. Now, when he made the decision to do it, it was his way of saying, look, we're going to do something, but it is not tied to the Palestinians. This is at a time when Yasser Arafat was still alive. This is at a time when he was trying to say, we don't have a partner. We're going to do something on our own. The fact is, however, it does create an opportunity for the Palestinians, because if the Palestinians are able to govern themselves, fulfill their security obligations, demonstrate that they can handle things, and they show that Gaza is an effective model, then it becomes, for the world and for the Israeli public, a model that could be applied to the West Bank. If they are not able to do that, then in fact you have the opposite image of chaos, violence, and why would you take that model and apply it to the West Bank?
Shibli Telhami, if this was done over the Palestinians' head, how do they respond to it?
Well, first of all, I mean, no question, I think, whether not just from a Palestinian point of view or American point of view, Israeli point of view, if you look at it, in a detached fashion, clearly a withdrawal through an agreement would have been better, because it would have been something that's a common interest in both sides, and both publics would have seen it that way. The fact that it's unilateral clearly is not as good from the point of view of getting Palestinian support for it. Having said that, withdrawal is far better than no withdrawal. It's a good thing that it's happening. It is important. It is a precedent setting. It does open up opportunities. At the same time, there really are expectations that could be problematic, because clearly, in this environment, Gaza is in a terrible shape. A terrible shape economically. It's been devastated over the past few years. A terrible shape politically, security-wise. The challenge is enormous, and it's going to put a lot of pressure on not only Abu Mazen, but on all of the Palestinian factions to find a way to maintain stability, create some more economic activities, while at the same time working toward a broader peace. And I think the trouble with it being unilateral is that it didn't happen. It's not a consequence of something that Abu Mazen did. This is not an Abu Mazen success that he can tell the Palestinians, the Israelis withdrew because I was elected. Unfortunately, clearly the militant groups are going to be claiming this as a success for them, and it puts even more political pressure on him as he's going to iter the elections that he just announced in January.
Those are the local elections in January. Let's get some...
The legislative elections, actually.
800-989-8255, if you'd like to join us. 800-989-TALK, the email address, totn@npr.org. We'll begin with Jean. Jean calling from, is it Edina, Minnesota?
Edina, Minnesota.
Edina. Okay, go ahead.
I'm wondering why Israeli settlers are not given the choice of staying in the Gaza Strip and live under Palestinian rule.
Is this a choice they're being offered, Dennis Ross?
No, it's not a choice they're being offered. Let me put this in some context. When we were at Camp David in the year 2000 and we were trying to resolve all the issues of the conflict, which seems a very long time ago now, there actually was a proposal at one point that Israeli settlers could remain in the West Bank and Gaza if they were prepared to remain under Palestinian rule. At that time, the Israeli side decided they felt that would create too many complications, so they didn't favor it. And I don't think the issue of staying under Palestinian rule ever occurred to Sharon because, first of all, I think there was a feeling that you couldn't know for sure what would happen to them. There was no confidence, that, in fact, that their security would be safeguarded. And there was a sense that if Israel was going to make a decision on Gaza, then it was going to be a unilateral decision in terms of not only getting out, but not discussing it with the Palestinians. I think Shibley's point about Abu Mazen not getting credit for this is right. It would have been easier for him if, after Arafat was gone, there was more of a clear-cut negotiating process where Israel said, we're getting out, now we're going to work out the sequence, the terms, the timing, everything with you. Then it would have shown that negotiations actually were paying off. That would have been one of the benefits of this. Unfortunately, that's not going to be the result right now.
Gene, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it. After hearing from one settlement, we're going to take a half-back step back to answer your questions today, the first day of the Israeli pullout from settlements in Gaza and the northern West Bank. Call us to ask about this landmark evaluation, the uprooting of more than 8,000 settlers, how it's being done, why it's being done, what this landscape is likely to look like afterwards. 800-989-8255 or email us, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It is a moment pregnant with hope, but also fraught with peril. That's how one of the UN's chief Middle East coordinators described the evacuation of Israeli settlements in Gaza and the northern West Bank, which began today. The pullout ranks as one of the most significant changes in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict since 1967. Tens of thousands of Israelis rallied in Jerusalem on Friday to protest the pullout. You're invited to join us today with questions about what makes this so important. Will Israelis maintain their military post? Who controls the border? How might this affect U.S. involvement in the peace process? 800-989-8255. 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our guests are Dennis Ross, a former special Middle East coordinator during the Clinton administration and director of Near East and South Asian Affairs on the National Security Council during the Reagan administration. Also with us, Shibley Telhami, professor for peace and development at the University of Maryland and an American delegate of the Anti-Incitement Committee mandated by the Y River Agreement between Israel and the Palestinians. And again, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. And a basic question about this withdrawal, Dennis Ross, who benefits?
Well, I think that, in a sense, both sides benefit. Even though it wasn't negotiated, at least the potential is both sides do. First, in the case of the Palestinians, understand that Gaza has the greatest population density in the world. And the Israelis, to protect the settlements and the settlers, have controlled about 25% of the territory. So when the Israelis get out of that, that means you're opening up one quarter of the territory of Gaza that has been off limits to Palestinians, and that's a major benefit just in terms of space. Also, now that the greenhouses and the dairy farm have been bought for Palestinians, it'll be Palestinian Authority will own it, but it will probably lease it out to Palestinian business. This can provide additional employment, which is desperately needed in Gaza, and it also reflects what are thriving businesses. So from a practical, psychological, physical standpoint, Palestinians benefit. From an economic standpoint, they can also benefit. Israelis also benefit, though, because even though it's very painful for the Israelis who have lived there, one of the issues that was raised that actually created a spur to getting out was not just the demographic question, which is important because of its trends, but also in places like Netzarim, you had 400 Israeli soldiers to protect 60 families there. There was an illogic of having large numbers of soldiers protecting small numbers of families. So from the standpoint of Israel's overall security posture, I think it's pretty clear that they're in a better position after being out of Gaza than they are while being in it.
Shibli Talhami, who benefits?
No question that both sides have some benefits out of this. I think you can argue that the Israelis certainly benefit a lot economically, militarily. Many Israelis felt that the Gaza settlements would drain on Israel. Some even wished that they would negotiate it away already in Oslo, even though the Israelis in principle didn't want to make that concession early on as part of final settlement. A lot of Israelis had felt that, you know, to protect just a little over 8,000 settlers, they were spending so much money and energy and lives. So they benefit, no question. I think the separation from Palestinians would help them. The Palestinians will have almost an end to the Israeli occupation. I say almost an end because it doesn't end until you have a state, really, and access to the outside world, because they remain dependent on Israel. But they benefit in that way. They have a new opportunity. I think, unfortunately, a lot of other groups benefit. Hamas benefits. Hamas benefits because it does have an ability to claim that it forced Israel out. It does benefit because it now has really kind of a new competition opened up in Gaza, in which the Palestinian Authority is weak, and they have a chance to advance. So I think there are many parties who benefit from this, but the question is, what are the risks? And there are enormous risks, one of which is what I call the gap of expectations. I think each side is expecting this withdrawal to lead to something else. And I think that is going to become a problem as they both turn to their domestic politics in the months ahead. The Palestinians and the Israelis will be, in essence, trying to put their political house in order at home, and that's going to escalate the rhetorical game and make them take harder lines than in the past on final status issues at a time when there is a different interpretation of the timetable, at least, of when the negotiations would start over final status questions, and what is the timetable of a Palestinian state, if at all, in the coming months.
Here's a question sort of about what happens next. This is from Waleed Hasboun. Does Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention apply to the remaining settlements in the West Bank, which would mean all settlements and many other Israeli occupation practices are illegal? Moreover, does this engagement mean that Israel is now in compliance with Article 49 as related to Gaza? Dennis Ross?
Well, with regard to Gaza, the Israelis will be out. So they are no longer an occupying power. The Geneva Convention relates to the issue of the occupying power mm-hmm. and the responsibilities the occupying power has. Israel will still be the, quote, occupying power in the West Bank, so the Geneva Convention would still apply there.
And, well, what about the West Bank? If it's proved so difficult and so fractious, so divisive to the country of Israel to order these withdrawals from Gaza, which are presumably easier than some of the other more difficult areas in the West Bank, what does that say about the prospect of withdrawal from the West Bank?
Well, again, let's put this in some perspective. Number one, there's no question that from the standpoint of the settlers want to be raising the emotional costs of the withdrawal. I don't believe you're going to see violence. There could be some isolated episodes of it. I don't think you'll see violence because this is a citizen army on the Israeli side. Violence against the Israeli army will create a terrible backlash in the Israeli public against the settlers. So settler leaders don't want there to be violence. There may be younger people, highly ideologically motivated, who may see things a little differently, but for the most part, I don't think we'll see violence. So I think, number one, yes, the settlers want to create an emotional reality that makes it difficult to apply this precedent to the West Bank. On the other hand, I go back to where I started. The Israeli public will be watching. The whole world will be watching. If Palestinians are able to overcome their own differences, if the rivalry between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority and Fatah is something that can be somehow managed so that, in a sense, there's a common approach to what happens not only during the period of withdrawal but in the next couple of months so that, in fact, we see the calm preserved, we don't see violence erupt. If that's the case, then it seems to me that you begin to demonstrate that there's a model that does work. It's a model where the Palestinians, when they assume governance for themselves, they really do assume responsibility. When we see manifestations of Palestinian responsibility in one place, it may well be easier to sell it in another place. From that standpoint, though this is bound to be very difficult, and we shouldn't underestimate the emotional trauma it's going to cause within Israel, I don't think it's the end of the road if, in fact, it ends up being managed well. Now, the real question, and Shibley was raising this, the real question is management not only right now, but over time. One of the things that has made me uneasy has been that the what I call the security for access nexus. The Israelis want security after out of Gaza. The Palestinians want free, unencumbered access into and out of Gaza. If the security arrangements...
Air routes, seaport,
that's right. Okay. And overland.
And
so,
overland from
so
Egypt.
There isn't, so there isn't smuggling, including into Israel and to the West Bank, because the main market for Gaza, economically, is the West Bank and vice versa. So they want practical links there. Now, the crossing points, the passages, the practical links, all of these issues have partial agreements. There isn't one in which there is a full understanding right now. And the problem that I see is that once the Israelis get out completely, when you begin to implement the arrangements, they're going to be implemented only after the Israelis are out. And at that point, I can tell you, knowing something about them, they're all complicated. Complicated arrangements never go simply, and the net effect of that is you will end up refining them after the Israelis are out, which means when there's a problem, the Israelis will put a squeeze on the access.
If I may, let me just look at it from a slightly different angle. I mean, I agree with Dennis on the necessity of Palestinians doing all they can to put the political and economic house in order to make the best of this an opportunity. You know, I think they have a huge challenge, and I'm not, you know, I'm not entirely sure it's going to work out exactly as we all hope. But let's assume it does, and let's hope that it does. If you're looking at it from the point of view of the Israelis, this was a unilateral withdrawal to minimize the number of attacks on Israel, to bring about a level of relative security, to postpone final status issues. If, in fact, there is a withdrawal and Sharon manages to regain the upper hand in Likud, he's a popular man overall because he will have managed to pull this off, a withdrawal from Gaza, increasing security, maintaining the support of the U.S., getting even Arab countries and to some extent the Palestinian Authority to indirectly cooperate with him in the withdrawal. He doesn't want to move to final status negotiations. He doesn't want to deal with those difficult issues. The Israeli public, if the Palestinians are peaceful and they have their Gaza corner, what's the incentive for the Israeli public to push a prime minister of Israel who's not inclined to move in that direction? What's the incentive for them to move him in that direction? Why wouldn't they just sit comfortably and say, and when he argues to them, I've done this all on my own, this is what I want to do. And I don't see where the incentive is going to come, Dennis. Maybe you could tell me how this is going to generate some kind of public sentiment that would push it forward.
And briefly, if you would.
All right. Look, first we have to understand the context. There is going to be pressure within Israel to do nothing until the next Israeli election. Sharon is going to sink a pause until that election, which will probably bring in the spring. On the Palestinian side, obviously, this is the gap in expectations because Abu Mazen is going to want to be able to demonstrate that it was Gaza first and not Gaza last. So first things first, you're going to have to be able to create a bridge that gets you through to the next elections. I think that the Israeli public as a whole knows you can't just do Gaza and nothing else. So the question is not about what happens between now and the next Israeli election in terms of permanent status. The question is, what is the political process that's going to be in the aftermath of the next Israeli election, and how do you build a bridge to that point so that everything doesn't fall apart in between when you have a crisis over the gap in expectations? I believe in the end the Israeli public, if they see that there's calm, they're going to understand that, all right, we still have a demographic problem. We're still going to have to sort that out. And let's, if we actually have a partner now, then let's pursue that pathway. If we don't have a partner, there'll be no pressure.
As we mentioned, some settlers have vowed to defy authorities until the last minute. Some have already been moving in accordance with the disengagement plan, particularly those who live in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. Joseph Ayalon is a lifeguard who lived in the northern settlement of Dugit for 15 years. Yesterday, he moved from his home there, and he joins us now by phone from his new home in Nativ HaAshelra. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Nice of you to join us today.
Hello, Nativ HaAsara.
Okay, thanks very much for that. Knowing how many people were, why did you decide to leave?
I'm not decide to leave. Our Prime Minister, Ariel Sharon, he has a government, and the government decided to just move us out of Gaza.
Yet, as you know, other people are planning to resist, at least till the last moment. You decided to move ahead.
Sorry, I don't understand.
So why did you decide to leave earlier than some of your neighbors?
Yeah, it's just because we don't want any problems with the army, any argues, any fighting, you know. We are in the northern territory of Gaza. We decided to not develop any problems, any conflict with the soldiers. And this is the reason that we left before.
It must have been difficult, nevertheless, to leave the place you'd lived for so long.
Yes, that's right.
What were your emotions as you left for the last time?
It's unbelievable. It never happened to me before. It's very hard to leave my home. I had very good life here. Beside all the attacks, terror attacks, and the missiles, we had very good life here. So it was very hard to leave the house near the beach.
Did you receive compensation for deciding to leave?
Oh, yes. Yes, they was very kind, and it wasn't so bad that I thought before, but it was emotional.
Mm-hmm. Despite the pain for yourself and so many other families, do you think that this could be, in the long run, good for Israel?
Yes. If we want to see from the international view, I think, my friends, that it will be good. Not tomorrow, but in the process, we believe that it will be maybe a good step forward to the future.
Joseph Iallone, thank you for joining us today. We appreciate your time. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Joseph Iallone used to live in the northern Gaza settlement of Dugit. For more analysis and background on the Israeli pullout from Gaza, including maps and photos, you can visit our website at npr.org. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is Dr. Awad calling from Kansas City.
Hello, this is Dr. Awad.
Yes, go ahead.
I am a U.S. citizen, but my parents lived in Gaza in the 40s. So I do feel very bad for the Israelis that were evicted out of their what they consider their homes, because the same thing happened to my parents in the 1940s. When they forced out of their lands and they moved out of the country. My question is, what's going to happen now to these settlements? My parents claim that they do have a land in that area that belongs to them, and they have evidence, paperwork, that these lands belong to them. So what's going to happen to the settlements?
Shibli Telhami, can you help us out?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure what area the gentleman is talking about, because, of course, Israel really didn't control Gaza in 48. Gaza was occupied in the 1967 war. The caller may be talking about other Palestinian towns and areas that were that came under Israeli control after the 1948 war. The Gaza settlements were really not built, unlike many, for example, Israeli towns and neighborhoods that were built on old Arab neighborhoods in a variety of places in what is now Israel. In Gaza, actually, the settlements were not like that. They were not built on remnants of Palestinian towns by and large. There are a lot of claims, obviously, for property. This is all now tied up into the negotiations and part of the final status agreement, which is the issue of the right of return and or compensation to the refugees who left. There are a number of international resolutions that have been sort of accepted as a basis of negotiation. This is a final status issue. It hasn't been decided. It's one of the most difficult ones. Everybody understands that when it does happen, there's going to have to be some significant economic compensation package as well as other kind of arrangements to deal with it.
Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
And we're going to continue our Q&A about Gaza when we come back from a short break, taking your questions about the history of the region, the disengagement process, perhaps the relatively quiet response to the pullout by the American Jewish community. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our guests are Shibley Talhami, the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland, and Dennis Ross, whose most recent book is The Missing Piece, The Inside Story of the Fight for the Middle East. Again, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. We'll also get you an update on the draft constitution in Iraq. I'm Neil Cohn, and it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. And right now we'll wrap up our conversation on the extraordinary day in the Middle East, the first day of the withdrawal from 21 Israeli settlements in Gaza and four on the northern West Bank. Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255. Our email address, totn@npr.org. Our guests are Dennis Ross, former special Middle East coordinator during the Clinton administration, now a counselor at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and Shibley Talhami, professor for peace and development at the University of Maryland and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. And let's get an email question in. This from Stuart. Could you please ask your guests whether they think improving the economy of the Gaza Strip would help to reduce Palestinian tensions with Israel? Also comment on some specific economic development proposals I've heard about: a shipping port in Gaza, expanding agricultural production and processing facilities, building more housing and institutional facilities, developing seaside tourism along the southern coast evacuated by Jewish settlers. He says he can't see anybody booking a family vacation on the Gaza Strip. Well, you never know. Shibley Talhami, what about those proposals?
There's no question that the economic component is extremely important for bringing about stability and ultimately, I think, in helping create an environment that's suitable for negotiations. I could tell you that in public opinion surveys I've done in the Arab world broadly, that income is the single most important predictor of attitudes. It is just extremely important. I think when you look at the devastation in Gaza, we don't know exactly what the percentage of unemployment is, but it wouldn't be surprising if it's more than 50%. It is a circumstance that clearly is ripe for radicalism, for exploitation, and the Palestinian Authority is not going to be able to do it on its own. It requires enormous resources, and there should be a lot of projects. The Europeans have already agreed to put money on the table to help the Palestinian Authority after the withdrawal. They're going to have to implement that. There are a lot of NGOs. One of them I should mention, and out of self-interest, I'm on the board of this organization called the Education for Employment Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization trying to start skill-type schools in Gaza, undertaking the idea of being a partnership between American NGOs and Palestinian NGOs to create schools that would help people develop skills, because part of the problems that we see is people often have degrees that are not really particularly useful for the work environment. In this case, to provide cutting-edge kind of education that would help them get employment and partner with big corporations, local corporations, multinational corporations, to employ them immediately after. This would be just a small enterprise, but there are a lot of different projects of this sort that are going to be needed to bring about some kind of economic stability in Gaza.
Dennis Ross, the outgoing president of the World Bank, is involved in raising some of these funds.
Absolutely. Look, I think one of the most important things that takes place right now is translating what have been pledges of assistance into practical projects on the ground, especially labor-intensive projects on the ground. The unemployment rates in Gaza are at least 50%. The people in Gaza, about two-thirds, are living under $2 a day. If you want to transform the situation, create a sense of hope, demonstrate that life is changing for the better, and show that the Palestinian Authority is the one delivering it, so that the authority of Abu Mazen goes up and the ability of groups like Hamas to challenge him, compete with him, goes down, you have to change the reality on the ground, and it has to happen quickly. So far, the approach to providing assistance has been a very business-as-usual approach. One has to hope that in the immediate aftermath of the Israelis being out, you see real building begin very quickly, because that, in fact, can change the whole psychology of the area.
Let's get a couple of calls in. Scott. Scott calling from San Jose, California. Hello, Scott.
Yes, I'm here.
Yes, go ahead. You're on the air, Scott. Just about to hang up on
I was wondering if there was any connection between leaving structures intact and compensation. I think as a settler, I would feel compelled to follow my government's instructions, but not necessarily leave my home to be occupied by somebody else.
And Shibley Talhami, we did see evidence of people burning their houses in the newspapers this morning.
Well, actually, you know, the reality of it is there's always been this discussion of what to do with these houses. Should we turn them over as compensation? You know, why waste such a structures that have been built, or should they be destroyed? And,
right.
You know, I'm sympathetic with the destruction argument, because despite the economic logic of not doing it, I think the
right.
politics and the symbolism is absolutely difficult for both sides down the road. You've got, you know, many Arabs felt it was very difficult to see Jews living in their own homes. And I think Jews will feel very, very, it'll be very difficult for them to see Arabs living in their home. And this could be a source of conflict down the road. So I see a logic for the destruction.
Mm-hmm. Well, there has been a deal that has been done on the houses. And it was that there'd be destruction. The Israelis would destroy, would remove potentially toxic material. The Palestinians would then be responsible for dealing with the rubble. They would be paid to do cleanup, but also to compress some of it so it could be used for building materials as it relates to some of the infrastructure. That's one general point. But another one, a year ago when I was in Gaza, I heard from Palestinians at the time that they wanted the Israelis to destroy the houses. And there were three reasons at the time. First was because Yasser Arafat was there and they feared that only his cronies would benefit from it. Second, these are all single-family dwellings, and the structure of Israeli families in Gaza don't fit the structure of Palestinian families in Gaza, which are much larger. And so therefore they wanted high-rises to take the place of these. And third, Palestinians said, this is the way we know for sure Israelis are not coming back.
One other question, Dennis Ross. If Israelis are going to be evicted forcibly by midnight tomorrow, at that point, why does the withdrawal take 3 weeks?
There are a couple of factors here. First, the Israelis are going to be evicting people in sequence. They're talking about units of 17 soldiers and police who will go into each individual house to deal with those who are there. Second, even after you go the time it takes, it's going to be beyond 3 weeks for Israel to get out of Gaza. It'll be at least another month. Because after all, there is a buildup of 38 years of infrastructure, military as well as civilian. And so to be able to dismantle all of that infrastructure is going to take them some additional time, as well as making sure that the demolition of the houses is done in a way that actually fits with the agreement that has been worked out with Jim Wolfenson.
Thank you very much to you both. We appreciate it. Dennis Ross is the author of The Missing Piece, the inside story for the fight for the Middle East, and a counselor at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He was with us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you as always, Ambassador.
Nice to be here.
And Shibley Talhami, Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, from where he joined us today. Again, Professor Talhami, always nice to have you on the program as well.
Good to be with you and with Dennis.
When we come back from a short break, the latest on agreement from Baghdad.